And good morning, everybody, on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Alexander Hordes is a lawyer who lives in Baltimore and who has studied the mafia for many years. And he's published several articles about the long reach of La Cosa Nostra in virtually every aspect of life in New York and elsewhere. In his new book, he argues that much of what we think we know about the mob is simply part of a mythology that has been fueled over decades by self-serving autobiographers and Hollywood. He'll be speaking tomorrow night at the Pratt Library about his book, and in particular, the mafia's historic role in the evolution of gay nightlife in New York, a scene that most people don't associate with organized crime. This morning, Alexander Hordes joins me in Studio A. Good morning. It's good to meet you.
Thank you for having me.
So here's a little clip from The Godfather.
Someday, and that day may never come, I'll call upon you to do a service for me. But until that day, accept this justice as a gift on my daughter's wedding day.
So, you know, there's Marlon Brando, the beneficent yet threatening godfather. We do have so many of our impressions about
Absolutely.
The mafia from The Godfather, The Sopranos, etc. What's missing in these accounts? What's not accurate?
Well, look, these are put together by some of America's greatest artists. I mean, Martin Scorsese, Francis Ford Coppola, and these are, you know, spectacular images. They didn't get a lot of the history too accurate when they were putting these movies together. You know, and I love them too, but they tend to gloss over some of the ugly stuff. They also just ignore what I think is even more fascinating reality behind Cosa Nostra in New York and the other cities around the United States. You know, one of the most fascinating angles that I had never really heard of until I had started looking into it was, you know, the mafia owned many gay bars in New York City.
Now, that is an interesting connection, the gay bar scene in New York. Why do you think the mob was interested in gay bars in particular? Were gay bars a better target for them than straight, you know, regular nightclubs?
Well, that's a great question. It's a couple of reasons. One of them, yes, they were very vulnerable to shakedowns and to bribes from police officers. But you know, we often forget just how severe the legal closet was. After Prohibition was repealed, there was a whole new panoply of laws that really made it essentially illegal to be gay in New York City. It was actually illegal for a bar to serve liquor to homosexuals. It was actually illegal to hire gay people as bartenders. And as a result, gay bars were effectively outlawed. The state liquor authority would revoke their liquor license, which is anyone knows who owns a bar is a death sentence. And so the only group that could really stand up to that was the mafia. They were in New York City. They had the clout and the cash to stand up to the police and to sort of hold the police off at bay enough in order for them to run these sort of exclusive gay bars and nightclubs throughout New York City.
And you write in your book that pre-Prohibition and post-Prohibition gay life was very different kettle of fish. In the 1890s up through the 1930s, there was a very active open gay scene in New York, but then Prohibition just shut all that down.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating kind of history. It was actually better to be gay in 1920 than it was to be gay in 1950 in New York City. And George Chauncey, an historian at Yale, has really documented just how open and vibrant and relatively tolerant gay life was in the 1890s and 1930s. It was really more of a backlash to prohibition, homosexuality. You know, they're still debating why exactly it happened, but there was a really severe imposition of a closet. And we often forget just how severe and bad that closet was for gay people. It was not only a social closet, but it was actually a legal closet. You could go to jail simply for being gay in public.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. Alex Hordes is my guest this morning. We're talking about his book, The Mob in the City, The Hidden History of How the Mafia Captured New York. Were there higher profit margins for the mob in gay bars than there were in other enterprises?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, well, these were cash cows for the mafia. They had some glamorous nightclubs, but for the most part, a lot of the gay clubs were sort of dumpy spaces. They were basically had monopoly on in Greenwich Village on gay bars. And so as a result, they didn't have to put a whole lot of money into it. In some cases, they didn't even own the place, but they sort of muscled in on an existing bar owner. They set up these protection rackets, and then they would fuel the place with this awful alcohol. They used to call it mafia house beer, and nobody knows exactly what was in a lot of these. They would bootleg it. They would, you know, moonshine it. They would literally steal it off the back of trucks. They would take out the Dewar's bottles, empty them, and fill them up with water and with other noxious substances. And then they would charge, you know, two or three times what anybody else would pay in, in any other bar.
I guess they were taking advantage of the fact that if you're a gay person, you have very limited places you can go and meet other gay people. And so you sort of take what you can get. And if the bars ended up being a dump, and if the liquor was overpriced and it wasn't any good, you just sort of accepted that because you had no other options.
That's a great point. I mean, a lot of the times it was not actually the mafia that created the system, and the bartenders who worked at these bars, are often have some, fond reminiscence of their actual owners. It was lousy for the system, but that's exactly what it was. The mafia specialized in illegal markets, and even better if they could corner the market on something. And so in New York City, that was gay nightlife, which was effectively made illegal. So they had a very, very large gay population with not many places to go. And so they have to pay high prices for, often sort of, lousy amenities.
So the Stonewall riots in 1969, you write that to a certain extent, that was as much a reaction against the mafia as it was against the police. How come?
Yeah, this is also the work of Martin Duber and David Carter. But what they showed and what's confirmed in my research is that the patrons who went to the Stonewall were very much aware that the system they were under was run by the mafia, and they were very much chafing at all the problems with this. They still had to put up with raids, they still had to pay these high prices, they were still subjected to a lot of street harassment by cops. And so what happened that night, as far as we can tell, is that there was an unscheduled raid by a relatively honest vice cop who came in, and he by all accounts, said that he was going principally after the mafia. Now, would that have happened at a straight bar? Probably not. But he, his goal was not actually to have just sort of yet another raid. But the patrons rightfully objected to the raid, and they start to fight back, led by the drag queens, in fact, and they fought back against the police, and they fought them to a standstill. And you'll see, actually, in the days following it, they start handing out leaflets protesting the mafia system. Somebody writes on the graffiti on the stone wall, gay prohibition corrupts cops and feeds mafia. They were very aware that they were dealing with the mafia in this system.
You write about bars with names like the Howdy Club, which was, I guess, a popular lesbian hangout. There's another place called Club 181. On a typical night, who's in these bars? What kind of entertainment do they have? Who's going there?
It was a mix. The Howdy Club, for example, was a club, the first known club that we know that seemed to cater to lesbians, and they would actively promote it. And so it would be a mix of sort of gawking straight people and couples who wanted to, quote, slum. It would also be, an awful lot of gay and lesbians who made it their own, who made the place their own. And they were very, happy, to have been a part of the Howdy Club. And then you'd have gangsters and racketeers, and they would come by, they would be running it, and they'd visit it. Vito Genovese, owned many of the gay bars in Greenwich Village. His capo regimes, ran and owned many of these bars. The Club 81 was actually a nationally known, very famous club. It was called the Homosexual Copacabana, and it was apparently very luxurious, very beautiful. And it was celebrities would come and visit it from out of town, actually, when they came in.
You write about the mafia imprint on virtually every aspect of life in New York. And you say that the rise of the mafia is very closely aligned with the history of New York itself. In what ways?
Yeah, that's a great question. The way that a lot of mafia books and movies portray it. They sort of have these sort of black hat villains that walk off a stage right and they sort of take over the city. And I don't think that that is accurate. I think that they were very much integrated into the city. So some of the areas that the mafia was involved in, you know, New York City had an enormous heroin addict population. So the mafia serviced the addict population. They moved a lot of the heroin over through the Corsicans. The mafia had an outsized influence in the nightlife, you know, in addition to the gay nightlife. You know, Frank Costello owned the Copacabana. They effectively ran professional boxing in New York City. They owned a lot of the, you know, they had a lot of influence over many industries, including construction, waste hauling was subject to a cartel. The waterfront, of course, is very famous. And so any place where you have to move goods and you have to have services that have to go quickly in the tight confines of New York City, the mafia was often present and often had an influence. And they would sort of use their muscle and their sophistication to sort of set up these elaborate racketeering schemes to skim New Yorkers. It ended up being what's called the mob tax. And so one of the reasons New York was so expensive was because everybody was sort of paying a little bit more than they would have. And that was in part because of corruption and also because of the mafia.
You write about the fact that there was an Irish underworld, there was a Jewish underworld, there was a black underworld. Why is it that the Italian underworld sort of rose to the top of the heap when it came to organized crime?
You know, that's something that fascinated me for a long time. I always wonder, why did the mafia families come out on top? And I come up with some ideas and arguments. I think, you know, you have to look at the demographics of the city. The city was changing over rapidly between the 1920s and 1930s. It was before that the immigrants were largely German and Irish. They eventually, you know, become more assimilated. You know, they go into politics, they go into the police force. And so the Irish gangs disappear. And then you have coming along sort of the Jewish immigrants. And they sort of have a one generation sort of a small population of organized crime gangsters that are very active, and so the Sicilians come along after these groups, and so they come along at just the right time. They come along just as Prohibition is going into effect, and they come along just as in New York City the labor movement is going to effect, and so they're sort of latching on to the labor movement, and they're coming into place when there's telephones. And there's cars. And so they sort of had perfect timing for this.
Timing is everything.
Timing is everything.
And unfortunately, we're out of time. But Alex, I appreciate your coming by. Thanks so much and have a good time at the Pratt.
Thank you for having me.
Alexander Hordes will speak tomorrow night at the Mafia's historic role in New York's gay nightlife based on the research that he's done for his book, The Mob in the City, The Hidden History of How the Mafia Captured New York. He'll speak at 7 o'clock tomorrow night at the Enoch Pratt Central Library in Baltimore. The event is part of the Enoch Pratt Writers Live series, and it's co-sponsored by the Free State Legal Project, which provides pro bono legal services to LGBT individuals. We've got more information on our website. Come to WIPR.org/Maryland Morning, and we'll give you a link to all the details. Tomorrow morning, Sheila has a conversation with Lieutenant Governor and gubernatorial candidate Anthony Brown, and I'll talk with the author Stephen Galloway. His last book was The Cellist of Sarajevo. His new book is a terrific tale about Harry Houdini. I hope you can join us tomorrow morning on Maryland Morning. Also, we're looking for summer interns. If you're interested in making radio with us, go to our website for more information. Again, it's WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. For Sheila, Nathan, and the entire Maryland Morning team, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.